Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. I'm here for part three of a discussion on economics with Jerome Brook, executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. And he just said off the mic that there is a common theme between the way people in Europe and people in the United States, or at least leadership in both countries, think about the economy, and he wanted to make an observation.
Well, I think it's broader than just the leadership. So I think certainly we all know that in terms of the leadership, there's this approach to statism and government is the solution and so on. But I think there's something a little deeper. And that is that I think people have become in their thinking and in their mentality so short-term, so incapable of projecting the long-term that they are living the moment. And you see this more in Europe than in the United States. And therefore, take on as much debt as you want. Promise the world to the future. Who cares? It's living the moment. And you see this in Greece. Live beyond their means for over and over and over again. And then when it all collapses, then cry and complain and so on. But never take responsibility for this. We saw it in the housing crisis with individuals. There's this short-term mentality, irrational, that is incapable of projecting any kind of long-term consequences to actions.
In the long run, we'll all be dead. Lord Keynes, right?
That's absolutely the case. But whereas Keynes, I think, thought of this in terms of maybe decades, today the mentality is they won't even think beyond a few minutes or a few days or, in the best case, a few years.
Okay, let me turn to a few questions on China. There are two opposing views that I read alternately in the Wall Street Journal. One is that it's a mammoth, growing, powerful economic entity that is all but our competitor right now, and that's going to overshadow us very soon. And the other is, that's ridiculous. China is basically propaganda. Now, we have both been to Shanghai. We both loved Shanghai. We're both impressed by it. But, of course, we know that Shanghai is not typical. It's one of the few on the western coast there. But this is a question I want to ask you. If the West continues to go down, the way it's decay and inflation, et cetera, and China just remains as it is, won't it at some point, even if it's exaggerated by people today, become the dominant world power? Won't it shift to Asia if the West, in effect, collapses?
Well, I think certainly. I mean, by default, if the West collapses, I think the Chinese can probably survive longer, and they're certainly more tuned to dealing with poverty and dealing with problems. I think we in the West don't even know what poverty is like. I think civilization will completely collapse over here. I think in terms of the Wall Street Journal portrayal of China, I think it's a mixture of both. So there's certainly elements in China and Shanghai, parts of Shanghai are evidence of this, and other parts in where China, the Chinese central government, has allowed people freedom, has left them alone, where there's real production, there's real wealth creation, there's real growth happening. And then there's an entire segment of Chinese economy which is government-controlled, government industries, government banks, which is completely bankrupt and completely in default. And as long as there's enough growth in the places where they've allowed freedom, they can cover up the mess that is their government programs. When that flips, when do the problems exceed and the whole thing collapses? I don't know. You can't. All I know is it will happen. And then you could see civil unrest in China on a scale, that we haven't seen in since the big wars here, and then China could decline faster than the West. So
you mean anti-communists versus the communists, or what do you mean by civil?
Well, I don't think they're intellectual enough for them to think of it that way. First of all, I don't consider the government today in China communist government. They call themselves communists, but I think they're fascists. Yeah. They're dictators of some form or another. But communism as an ideology isn't what's driving them. So I view it as, the poor, which are probably 600-700 million in China, rising up and saying, we were promised a share of this wealth. We don't have any of this wealth. You guys cheated us. The middle class rising up and saying, wait a minute, we've got some economic freedoms, but we want political freedoms. And then the status quo, the army and the government saying, we're going to squash you both because we want to maintain control. So I think those elements within China, it's hard enough to predict exactly what's going to happen in this country and in the West and how it all plays out. It's almost impossible to predict what's going to happen to China. But I don't see China. I think there's real problems in China. And I think those real problems in China will come to the surface in the decades to come. So who declines faster and when it all happens is really difficult to predict.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that the leadership of the communists in China aspire someday, if they could achieve the power, to world conquest the way Germany and Russia did, or not?
I don't. I do think they want to be dominant in Asia, but I don't think I don't think they're thinking that term. I do think they want Taiwan back, and they want to be the dominant player in that region. But I think they've got so many problems at home right now that I don't think they're thinking that far ahead.
Do you think, and last question on China, that if the West were to go in the direction of freedom and, blossom that way, that would have or could have a significant effect on China in the sense of pushing the dictatorship on the defensive?
There's no question in my mind. I think the reason China is as far along today as it is because so many Chinese have visited the U.S. and other places and want that and desire that, and they see the wealth in the West. I think we are the model for the rest of the world. America's always been the model. The reason places like Japan and places like South Korea and Taiwan are as free as they are is because they modeled themselves after us. If we decline, they will decline as a consequence. If we improve, if we actually become freer, they will benefit enormously from that. And of course, we will as well because we're all traders.
Okay, thank you, on China. I want to just zip through a few of these Republican candidates. You know, I know that's a big jump, but give you a few names. Give me your capsule estimate. You don't have to give a long reason why, because it's probably obvious, but just a capsule. And how you would estimate their chances of nomination, knowing that we're almost a year ahead of time. So, okay, the two leaders are Perry and Romney. So start with Perry.
I think Perry has a decent shot. A few weeks ago, I thought he would have a better shot than, he seems to be floundering a little bit. He's nowhere near as articulate as I hoped he would be. He's very religious, which is a real problem.
Is he a fundamentalist type? Born again?
He's a born-again evangelical type who held
that.
Prayer. The weekend before he was nominated, had a weekend of prayer in Houston for the economy.
No kidding. I didn't know he was.
And a year ago, they actually prayed for rain in Texas. And it didn't help. surprise, surprise. So,
So, and then he is out on that grounds or not?
Well,
I mean, you put him with the other religious.
I don't know how much of this is playing to the evangelicals or how much he really believes in it. The problem with him is that, on the one hand, he said that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, which. He rose, in my estimate, dramatically when he said that. But then he couldn't really defend it, and he's kind of weaseled. He's kept a Ponzi scheme, but then weaseled in terms of what the implications are.
If a person says something repeatedly and acts like the prayer meeting and so on, I don't think it matters whether he's sincere or not. I mean, if he wore a swastika and everything.
No, you're right.
It wouldn't matter whether he believed it or not. To me, what you're saying, if that's true, wipes him out as a possibility.
Well, I mean, again, I think he's probably the likely winner, and I think that he would, I think it would be one more step towards you know, the increased influence of religion so on American politics.
So it'd be another step in the direction of what I predict in my book.
A very scary step towards what you predict in
but, Denver. But that would be true of quite a number of these candidates, like like Bachmann.
Bachmann,
she's even more religious.
She's even more religious. She comes from a fringe group of evangelical Lutheran, and she actually switched religious affiliation just before she announced a candidacy because she realized that if she was linked to the original group that she was affiliated with, she didn't have a chance because it was so ludicrous. So she claims to become more mainstream religiously, but I don't believe it. And again, I think a very, very scary candidate.
She's one of the ones that believes that the dinosaurs and Adam and Eve went to the same movies or whatever it is, something like that, right?
Yes, they believe. All these people believe that the world is 6,000 years old, and to the extent that dinosaurs existed, they must have existed at the same time as man did. I've even heard, I don't think it's from evangelical, I've heard this theory, and that is that the bones of dinosaurs are just a plot by God to test us. I mean, he would be clever. You got to give him credit for that.
I didn't even comment on that. Sarah Palin's in the same category, right?
And a lot less intelligent, in my view. She's not. Perry and Bachmann are at least intelligent, at least to some extent. I don't think she's intelligent at all.
Okay, now the two that are highest in the polls, at least as of the moment that I read, are Romney and Ron Paul. Romney is supposedly the only one who beats Obama in the polls. Obama, a quote, generic Republican beats Obama every time. Yeah. But as soon as they make it a specific person, people don't want it. So now Romney, you know, I don't understand how it's possible to vote for him after the fact that he is the creator of Obamacare.
He is. Romney Care in Massachusetts is exactly Obamacare. He is a middle-of-the-road, pragmatic Republican. I mean, I don't know why he's a Republican, but he reminds me, you know, he reminds me of your, maybe one of your favorite presidents, George Bush Sr.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, a middle of the road, nothing, no spine. You know, he claims to have business, he does have business experience, but you know what you need in government is not business experience. What you need is an understanding of some understanding of political philosophy and politics. And he's just I think he's a loser. He would be
what
awful.
What do you say about Ron Paul? He's supposedly the second highest at this instant.
I doubt that. I think Perry is the second highest and might be ahead. But Ron Paul is doing very well. I mean, it's quite astounding that he is doing, and it suggests to me, because some of the things that Ron Paul says, indeed many of the things he says, are true. You know, ending the Fed, you got to get rid of entitlements, all these things are all true. And the fact that he could get as many votes as he does, and the fact that he's so inarticulate and kooky is the best word I have for it, just doesn't come across as completely there. And he still gets all these votes, suggests to me that there is an appetite out there in American people for good ideas, for somebody with those good ideas. But Ron Paul is, in my view, he's religious. He doesn't believe in true separation of church and state. He just believes in shifting the influence of religion on the state to the states. He doesn't want it at the federal level, but he's okay if religion impacts our lives on the state level, which I think is a complete cop out and is a disaster.
Is he a libertarian in the formal capital L sense?
Well, yes. I mean, he ran as a presidential candidate for the Libertarian Capital L Party.
He combines the worst of subjectivism with religion.
He has a subjectivist and a religious combination. You know, his position on abortion is that he's against abortion, but he doesn't believe the federal government should have a role in it. The state should decide that. His position on gay marriage is he doesn't have a position. The state should decide. So he's and then on foreign policy, I've discussed this elsewhere. His positions are that the United States should take the blame for 9/11. We should apologize to the world for all our sins in the past. And
this is the question. I don't know who else would be involved, but of the ones we've mentioned, if one of them were the candidate and it was them versus Obama, would you vote? Obviously, you wouldn't vote for Obama. Or if you voted, you'd vote for this person. Would you do it?
So I have to give this disclaimer. I represent a 501c3, the Ayn Rand Institute, and as such, I cannot take a position. I'm legally restricted from taking a position. But personally...
Can't you whisper it to me, and then I'll say that's my viewpoint?
I mean, I just think, you know, I think we're in a catch-22, and it's a catch-22 that you predict in DIM. That is that the one alternative is the nihilism of Obama, which would destroy this country quickly. You know, if Obama's elected again, the economy has the potential to spiral out of control. And in this case, whereas with the Clinton era, I was pretty happy because Clinton and the Republicans kind of, there was gridlock, nothing happened. And, you know, it was the best possible world in a sense. Today, Obama is so awful that even with the Republican Congress and Senate, I think we would it would be a disaster for the country, and we're in much worse economic conditions than we were in the 90s. We're looking at a disaster. On the other hand, any one of these, you know, a Romney would is a Republican only in name. I don't think he's a nihilist, so I'd prefer him, I guess, to Obama. I think he's just a pragmatist, and if there
isn't it just sticking your throat that he created Obamacare, and now we're voting for him to save us from Obama.
Yes,
I just I don't know how you can swallow that.
But he's not a nihilist, so he would, you know, he would set us up for the next Obama. I think that's true, but at least he'd buy us some time. And a Perry, you know, a Perry would set us up for the long term. For a long-term disaster, but again, I think it buys us time. So my view still is, personally, the Institute, my personal view is that, you know, this is a short-term position. This is exactly the opposite of what I said earlier about short-term versus long-term.
You don't know what they're going to say tomorrow.
Then you have to go with a non-nihilistic candidate, although they plays right into your dim hypothesis and sets us up for the long-term disaster. But
you would draw the line at some of these people like Sarah Palin.
Yes, I you know, I couldn't, you know, some of these people would accelerate the kind of the coming of
the coming of the Lord.
Yes.
I want just one more question on the candidates, or rather on the election. There's a lot of talk about Clinton resigning as foreign minister and being the vice president, and that you'd have an Obama Clinton ticket. Yeah. Would that significantly improve the odds
of him winning?
Yeah,
it might. I mean, Biden, I think, is just a drag on him. But
they get the female vote,
maybe, and maybe. I mean, there's other rumors that she will run against him, although I don't think that'll happen, which would hurt him. You know, the other thing that hurts Obama is that he might get a challenge from somebody like Ralph Nader. Or somebody on the left who would drag some of the progressive vote away from Obama, which is a little absurd because I think he's about as leftist as a country would ever tolerate. So they're getting the best that they could get. The D2s are getting as good as it can be given the world that we live in today.
They attack him, but they resent one particle of something alive remaining. Standing, it's an affront to them.
Yes.
If you kill the entire tree, but there's one leaf that you haven't shredded, so he's got a hard job, you know, to keep his base happy. One final quick question: objectivists are all concerned to do something to improve the world, not just long range and by spreading philosophy. If you were to advise them on a concrete level. Of what kind of measure they should fight for specifically, of all the possibilities, is there any one or two that you would pick out and say, if you're going to fight for this or write letters for it and so on, not anything so general as remove regulation, but something that politicians could theoretically grasp, you know, was there anything you pick out?
Well, I would pick out Obamacare. I think it's a great issue because it really puts together the moral issue and the economic issue perfectly. But they shouldn't just argue against Obamacare. What the Republicans, I think, where they fail is they need an alternative. So the idea of privatizing healthcare is a relatively, of all issues, a relatively simple issue that I think people can grasp, that politician could grasp, and I think that as objectivists we can really rally around. It's an important issue that affects every one of our lives, and it's got a heavy moral component and a heavy economic component that can really, and I think we can make real progress because the American people seem to reject it. They're not for anything as an alternative. We can give them the what for as an alternative for it.
With the idea that when the Republicans, if they get both houses, will then repeal the whole thing.
Yes, although,
will they?
I'm skeptical about how much of it they will repeal. But again, the more we agitate for it and the more they view us. See, one of the things that we have an opportunity right now is to be viewed as an intellectual force in the political environment. There's an intellectual vacuum. You've got the Tea Parties, but they're not intellectual. And if we are presenting alternatives, if we're presenting solutions, if we're actually advocating for something, the Republicans might actually take our advice on an issue, which is, might be the first time that, if I can tell just an anecdote.
Yes.
I was at an event on Monday where five members of Congress and a senator spoke, and I was one of the speakers. It was members of Congress and me speaking. And a number of them came up to me afterwards and told me how much they loved Ayn Rand and they were huge fans. And I told them they should start an Ayn Rand caucus in the House, but that was a little too far for them. And one of them was telling me how he just read Ayn's West Point speech, which was one of her, I think, best public speeches, and just a fabulous speech, and how much that meant to him. He's a West Point graduate, and how much that meant to him and how important that was. I think for the first time in history, there's a significant number, maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen, of members of Congress who are fans. They're not objectivists,
but
they're fans.
You think as many as two dozen?
I think it's as many as two dozen.
And I remember when there were only one dozen human beings.
Yes. I think it's as many as two. Now, they might be religious, they might be all kinds of other things, but they're fans, at least two dozen. And then they're probably two or three or four senators. I think it's a real opportunity for us. These are the people we should be targeting. We should be giving them intellectual ammunition, and we should be fighting. Again, we're not going to convert them into objectivists. We're not going to change the political system overnight. But if they can just move a little bit in the right direction, it buys us time.
Okay, well, that is a hopeful conclusion and a piece of practical suggestion. So I want to wind this up. Thank you very much, Yaron, for taking all this time to answer questions I'm sure are obvious to you, but not to me, and I'm sure not to many people. So thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.